This edition of The Cinema Show was first broadcast on the 16th of January 2016 on Monocle 24. The Cinema Show in association with Mubi. This week on The Cinema Show, the skies are always sunny, the grass is eternally green, and the roses are always in bloom. We're wandering through suburbia in the cinema.
In the city, you can be a little strange and people don't really mind. But in suburbia, there's just enough room for you to need to conform. And if there's anything strange about you, you better get rid of it or move.
From the dark drama of Sam Mendes to the bright colors of Doris Day, suburbia on screen is never quite as simplistic as it seems. Join us as we peek through the peephole today on The Cinema Show, your culture guide to the world of cinema on Monocle 24. Welcome to The Cinema Show with me, Ben Ryland, where this week we peel back the curtains and peer through the Venetians for a sneaky look at suburbia in the cinema. Whether it's the repressed desire for youth and freedom that permeates through American Beauty, or the stifling bitterness flooding the gutters of Revolutionary Road. When cinema visits the suburbs, things are rarely ordinary. My guest today is the film critic Karen Krasanovich, who's just popped in for a cup of tea and a chat. Karen, welcome to The Cinema Show.
Hi.
We'll discuss some key titles that represent suburbia in the cinema shortly. First, Karen, I want to spend some time discussing the various ways that suburban settings are portrayed. Now, not only in the cinema, but on television too. There are some common themes, I think, running through American Beauty and Revolutionary Road, both directed by Sam Mendes, of course. One of which is this feeling of suffocation, which I think we also see in Julianne Moore's storyline in The Hours. Now, we were having a chat just before we started the show today about how suburbia can often feel stifling in real life, and I think that is something that we do pick up in depictions of it on screen as well.
Well, there's a reason why suburbia feels stifling. It's because suburbia was invented as a place to have a family. And in order to have a family that's safe, you have to actually put up barriers to things that you might see as dangerous to their well-being. And in which case, people feel sort of oppressed by either distance or even by buildings, for example, or proximity to other people. Suburbia is this petri dish where you can raise a family innocently and the child can grow up to the full value of its potential. Unfortunately, children don't want to do that. Children want to have adventures.
They want to rebel.
Exactly. Mm. And also, eventually, the parents want to, too. And I think that's the twist in the modern tales of suburbia. Of course, early on, in earlier films, suburbia was seen as a utopia.
Exactly. And I think that is one of the topics we're going to pick up on during our chat today, because there is a very clear difference between the way suburbia is represented in modern films that often look back on past eras. But then if you look back at films made during that time, they look at it very, very differently, as you've just said. But look, I saw the film Trumbo recently, starring Bryan Cranston as the Oscar-winning screenwriter Dalton Trumbo, who was blacklisted during the House Un-American Activities Committee hearings. And one observation that I made during that was, when Trumbo is living in his rural setting towards the start of the film, he seems to be quite happy and free. But then he's forced to downsize through the events that happen in the film, and he moves to the Los Angeles suburbs. And it seems like almost immediately at that point in the story, his swimming pool is vandalized, his neighbors trade nasty glares with him over the fence. Suburbia here is very much a symbol of menace.
Yes, very much so. And I think it's interesting that you observed that, where he was actually quite happy in a farm setting, and he pretends to be happy in suburbia until I think the children notice that neighbors are peering over the fence and being quite aggressive. The one thing in suburbia, they don't really like communists there. And of course, probably nowhere that I can think of. And of course, Trumbo was identified as such. And I think it's an interesting setting where he does pretend that, yes, this is fine, because obviously he's probably written a few suburban scenes in his mind and he knows the cliche of suburbia and the promise of suburbia, but he's living the reality of it, is the fact that you have to conform when you live in suburbia because you live too close together, not as close as you would in the city where you're allowed to be You know, in the city, you can be a little strange and people don't really mind. But in suburbia, there's just enough room for you to need to conform. And if there's anything strange about you, you better get rid of it or move.
We need to move on to a few of the titles that we are discussing today. Sadly, they do not involve any silly witchcraft, but we can move on to our first film, which is 2008's Revolutionary Road.
Sweetheart, what are you talking about? Where are we going to live?
Paris.
What?
You always said it was the only place you'd ever been that you wanted to go back to, the only place that was worth living. So why don't we go there?
You're serious?
Yes. What's stopping us?
What's stopping us? Well, I could think of a number of different things. For example, what kind of a job could I possibly get?
You won't be getting any kind of a job, because I will.
Karen, this film, of course, saw the reteaming of Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet after that little 1997 picture, Titanic. Remember that one?
No.
No, me either. Well, fittingly enough, both actors took away Golden Globes this week. Now, those wishing to revisit Revolutionary Road can do so over at Mubi. It's screening for subscribers here in the UK. Lucky you. Karen, let's swing open the door of 115 Revolutionary Road now. What's happening here?
Well, Frank and April Wheeler have, they don't see themselves as suburbanites at all. They see themselves as kind of a little bit superior to that. But they buy a house in Connecticut, which is very, very difficult for them to afford. And he works incredibly hard on a job that he hates. And meanwhile, she's this 1950s homemaker, a bit trapped, and they're all yearning for something that they can't have in this setting that's supposed to give them everything.
Now, that really taps into everything we know about suburbia in the cinema, doesn't it? It's really trying to be that ultimate example yet again, but in a very serious and dramatic way. There's a lot of suffocation that we're feeling during this film, isn't there?
Huge, huge. I mean, don't forget, the book had a huge following, and the fact that Sam Mendes took it on as a director meant that all eyes were on this film, and the performances are astonishing. But it's the resonance of what goes on here that applies to any time any of us end up in a situation where we're aiming for one thing and we find ourselves at this goal that isn't what we thought it was supposed to be.
And there's that common theme that runs throughout the film where we've got the symbolism of the city being the beacon of freedom. They often talk about Paris as though it's the solution to every problem that they've ever experienced, this idea that they can just run away from all of the constraints they find themselves in and live this bohemian creative lifestyle, which I think is the dream that a lot of people have, and it often takes the form of something that is a mere symbol.
Exactly. We all have this sort of, whether it's in our past and being nostalgic or what we think about, a relationship that we want, or if we bought this house or we moved to this country. Interestingly enough, that suburbia used to be that utopia for a lot of people. And we're trapped, cramped in the city, this terrible, squalid place. We'll go someplace where our children can breathe and we'll have grass and animals and rabbits on the lawn, And it's interesting that once we get out there, we realize that sometimes being cramped and in squalor or someplace of aged beauty, for example, is Paris, is going to do more for us than green grass and fresh air.
When we look at stories like this one, though, we can often play into the way that it's depicting its story by saying, well, they're so frustrated. Clearly, it's because they've got all these constraints that are put upon them by the suburban people that they live with, and the suburbia they find themselves in is spending all of his time on the road commuting to work and so on. Do you think sometimes it is, though, that the characters just cannot see some of the pleasures and benefits that suburbia can actually offer them?
Some people are very happy in suburbia, and some people learn to be happy
No.
in suburbia. Yes, some people do. Those are the people that drink a lot. You'll find bottles under their bed. Some people find a peace in suburbia. The characters in Revolutionary Road don't. They think they're different people than what they are, than who they are. And they're amazed about how the pressure of this idyllic area changes them. And I think that's the real interest here, where we think that we're going to grow in one way, and we surprise ourselves by not really knowing what's going to happen under these circumstances.
Well, that's 2008's Revolutionary Road, starring Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio. It's currently screening for Mubi subscribers here in the UK as part of a DiCaprio double bill. Who doesn't love a double bill? Alongside Steven Spielberg's Catch Me If You Can. Karen, I love the opening credits of that film, throwing back to the great Saul Bass.
Oh, amazing. Yes. Fantastic. And in the days when films used to have really exciting credits, it's so nice to see it again.
Exactly, exactly. Really building up on that anticipation. Well, still to come, we'll wander through the foggy streets of 1999's American Beauty. And winding things back a little, we'll revisit the perhaps somewhat accidental gender politics at play in 1963's The Thrill of It All. You're listening to The Cinema Show on Monocle 24, back right after this short break.
For our next Monocle property prospectus film, we head to Zurich's Kreisfeier. Once a red light district, its maverick and vibrant character now inspired designers and entrepreneurs to move into the neighbourhood.
You have this grand mix of everything, and you always see some crazy things or some inspiring things. And even though it's not the most sane commercial decision, it was just clear this is the vibe. And obviously the benefit is because it's exciting, it's also changing.
Zurich's unexpected new hood, Kreisfeier, is now playing in the film's menu on monocle.com.
This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24 in association with Mubi, the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. We're spending today looking at the many ways suburbia is depicted in the cinema. From 2008's Revolutionary Road and 1999's American Beauty, to the rather clever 1963 Doris Day comedy, The Thrill of It All. These are all intelligent titles that leave us pondering some interesting questions about the concept of suburbia, essentially a man-made version of what society deems the everyman's paradise should be. But whether it's Sam Mendes or Douglas Sirk behind the camera, it would be foolish to assume that the concept of suburban melodrama was born fully formed. One major influence is the television soap opera, a graduation of the old radio serials that proliferated in the early 1930s. They were labelled soaps because they were so often sponsored by soap manufacturers. But most importantly, they provided writers with an opportunity to explore human dramas and portray characters in situations involving emotional complexities, a departure from the cowboy adventures and cop shows. Needless to say, the term soap doesn't carry a whole lot of prestige. But as TV writer Matt Zoller-Seitz observed, when people refer to something as a soap opera, they're often talking about a series that they don't like. When a soap is deemed worthy, it becomes a serious drama. So how have these bubbling melodramatic serials influenced modern storytelling? Well, we asked Salon's TV critic Sonia Soraya for her take.
Like sands through the hourglass, so are the days of our lives.
Well, I think one of the things that's great about soap operas is they don't evolve. But certainly there has been quite an evolution in the way that soap operas treat issues around like homosexuality, single motherhood, rape is a really big one that's changed a lot in the way soap operas depict them throughout history. And then certainly now, in the era of people taking television a lot more seriously maybe than we ever have and discussing it in a different way, primetime soap operas, which are soap operas that are either glitzy enough or interesting enough or big budget enough that they're on the weekly broadcast thing, have become major touchstones. So Downton Abbey is an excellent example of a primetime soap opera. It is one of the most watched programs in the world. It has something like 150 million viewers. Or Empire, which is just debuted last year, and it became one of the most watched shows in America, like, overnight. I think that what's evolved is maybe people are taking that art form more seriously and seeing it as a real thing. Like, I think the television industry sees that that's a real way to engage viewers and to keep them coming back, especially viewers who, you know, have purchasing power and like hit the demographics that advertisers want. That's very valuable. The general structure of how a soap opera functions, how it continues to create its story, which is by constantly, it neither really introduces something new or ever resolves it. We're always in the middle of the action with the soap opera. That's a structure that works for all kinds of different stories, you know? And I think that what Dallas did, what it sort of mixed like this aristocratic Western story, you got like this Texas oil magnate family with this structure that otherwise worked really well. And I think you see that now reproduced in other forms. It's created a demand for television shows that aren't just these sort of long, filmic, beautiful things, such as, for example, I mean, I think you could make the argument that, like, The Wire does that really well. I'd actually argue that The Sopranos, people would have kept watching that for so long because people were really attached to the characters. I think that The Wire functions a little bit more like a snapshot that ends. You know, you sort of feel like there's a final point to it because it's not as much about the characters. But when shows really invest in their character, when audiences also really invest in those characters and want to keep seeing what they do, regardless of the quality at some point, I mean, that's a soap opera model. And I mean, I think in some ways that's also, it's a very fundamentally television model, which is why I bring it up. So for example, I think Grey's Anatomy is a very, especially now, very much a soap opera.
And if I did die today, I'd only be remembered as the slutty intern who dated two doctors.
No, one doctor, one vet.
Derek Finn. I'd die as a girl who couldn't make a choice, right?
To some degree, a soap, the addiction of watching something and needing to know what happens next, that's very fundamental to the soap opera. And again, I think it's very fundamental to television too. You know that, and this was more the case back in the day, like before the internet, but there used to be magazines that would tell you, like Soap Opera Digest, that would tell you what happened in the week if you hadn't had a chance to watch. So there's a strong, humans have a strong sense of investment in those stories. Something interesting too, I think, is one of my favorite shows that's currently on television is the show on the CW called Jane the Virgin, which very consciously takes not just the soap opera, but the telenovela, so the Spanish language soap opera, and both makes itself into a telenovela, but also is like a poking fun at the telenovela at the same time. And it's very interesting, I think, because it sort of does what we're talking about, which is it brings the addictive quality of, and the ridiculousness of the telenovela to primetime, but also is conscious of the ridiculousness and tries to address it, tries to be smart and thoughtful about it instead of kind of going whole hog crazy, as I think Grey's Anatomy, for example, has done.
You're listening to The Cinema Show on Monocle 24 in association with MUBI. We're spending today discussing the many ways suburbia is represented across our screens. The film critic Karen Krizanovich is here with me. Karen, we were just hearing about the often overlooked role that soap operas can play in storytelling. What are your thoughts on the humble soap?
Well, people like to kind of poo-poo soaps by saying, oh, you know, they're only for people with small minds, or they don't, you know, very wide, you know, shut-ins, people that don't get out very much.
Yeah, but representative of small lives, perhaps.
Exactly.
Nasty thing to say.
Yeah, it is. Or like, you know, your grandmother will watch it, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I think that actually that is doing them a disservice, because not only is this a global storytelling form, but I also think that it replaces, or in fact, aids relationships with your neighbors and with your community. Because in the old days, you would find out that, oh, Betty, she's seeing, oh, Lord, her boy, oh, you know, he's gay, oh, you know. So, you know, it's kind of a life substitute. But we need to get our emotional fulfillment from these kind of things. We need to have a bit of a roller coaster in order to keep us flexible. And I think that soap operas do that. They remind you of the beauty and the wonder. It's often very glamorous. I mean, in Britain, they're not. But in other countries, South America, Mexico, they're very, very glamorous. The Latino ones, particularly.
And
the Latino stars.
Very self-consciously silly.
And very silly.
That's a lot of people will look at them and say, oh, it's just a ridiculous story. What are you being entertained by that for? And you think, well, the whole idea is that it is ridiculous. Obviously, my neighbors are not really burying their ex-husbands under the pool. But that's why I'm watching it on television and not over the fence.
Exactly. It's strange that sometimes that does happen. I mean, it stuck in my mind as somebody said, you know, fiction has to make sense where fact doesn't. So strange things happen in real life. So when we see these things mirrored in soap operas, we think, oh, that would never actually happen. When you know every single thing that happened in soap opera happened for real somewhere, you just don't know where.
Oh, heaven forbid. Well, let's move on now to our next film, 1999's American Beauty.
Whose car is that out front?
Mine. 1970 Pontiac Firebird, the car I've always wanted, and now I have it. I rule.
Uh-huh, where's the Camry?
I traded it in.
Shouldn't you have consulted me first?
Let me think. No, you never drove it. Have you done something different? You look great.
Now, Karen, let's bring ourselves up to speed with this film here. It was, of course, the story of Lester Burnham, played by Kevin Spacey, a role that scored him the Oscar for Best Actor. Now, he's going through what could be called a midlife crisis, but it's really a lot more complicated than that, isn't it?
Well, yes, yes, because he gets a terrible sexual crush, I suppose, on his daughter's friend, who's played by Mina Suvari. Now, his wife is Annette Bening, so you think, come on, you've got this beautiful wife. But that doesn't matter, because Kevin Spacey's character is deeply cynical about life and hates where he's living, hates his life, and in fact starts working at a fast food restaurant, but snarling and spitting about it.
And the fast food restaurant it symbolizes freedom for him, though.
Absolutely.
Earlier in the film, he's seen working in, we're not entirely sure what kind of business it is, but it seems like some sort of telemarketing type role.
He's an advertising executive, which of course is one of these things in suburbia where you just think, it's either good or bad.
Yeah, that's very true. And there are a lot of things here that symbolize freedom. We were just talking about Revolutionary Road, and the freedom symbol there was Paris. Here, the symbol of freedom seems to be the naked Mina Suvari covered by rose petals in the imagination of Lester Burnham.
And that is his erotic ideal. And he knows that he shouldn't think about it, but he also knows that he can't help himself if he wants to be. And this is all about Lester Burnham being true to himself despite everything. And that is despite the suburban expectations of his wife, of his family, of his colleagues, and his neighbors, in fact, as well.
Perhaps just as equally interesting, or perhaps even more interesting than the peril that Lester Burnham finds himself in, is, of course, his wife, who you just mentioned was played by Annette Bening. Her storyline here is absolutely fascinating because her character starts off as this very, very stifled woman who seems to have put all of these constraints upon herself, because it doesn't seem as though her husband is expecting her to be anyone. She's put this massive expectation on herself, and then she looks up to this horrible, disgusting real estate man who really doesn't do her any favors whatsoever. What were your thoughts on her, the way her storyline plays out?
Well, what I find amazing about American Beauty, and it's actually kind of ahead of its time, is that when one character changes, it's almost like something, a cog has been moved in an engine, where it has a knock-on effect, where the rest of the family has to change its gearing as well. And I think that's exactly what happens to her, but in a very unexpected way.
And I think this really does play into what we were saying about soap operas before, because it's interesting to consider that Alan Ball, the writer of American Beauty, he actually conceived this story as a play originally, but after realizing that wouldn't work, scratched the idea, but revived it years later after he'd worked as a television writer. So again, we have that influence of TV and what some might call small stories making their mark on the cinema screen, which I think is evident here, because we have the story of Lester, which is the main crux of the story. But then we also have his wife's story. We have his daughter's story, played by Thora Birch. There's also Wes Bentley, the neighbor next door with the horrible father who beats him to a pulp. A horrific scene, but really pushes the story along and makes it full circle when he and Lester then have some sort of encounter quite late in the film. There's a lot of characters here, and they all manage to stitch together somehow.
I didn't mean to be laughing about the parental abuse there. I was actually laughing about the plastic bag, which has become emblematic.
Yes, it has.
Of this. And so many people have spoofed this, you know, the beauty of the plastic bag blowing in the wind. And, you know, litter. I mean, one thing about American Beauty, it's brought us the beauty of litter. We never really saw it before.
The beauty of litter.
You find it in suburbia. You find the strangest things in suburbia. But that's absolutely right. And I think that this film is ahead of its time in writing as well, because now the storytelling of films is coming together more than ever with the storytelling devices used in television. And eventually, I think we will be seeing a lot more crossover, not so much with big feature films, but with smaller stories, and also the fact that how stories are put together on television, the showrunner has a lot of say over how it's written and how it's produced, whereas in film, that isn't necessarily the case.
Let's move on to our final film for today now. Taking us down a rather different suburban street, it's the 1963 Doris Day comedy, The Thrill of It All.
Now, young lady, what the devil did you mean? That soap saved my life today.
Well, it was just a figure of speech, Mr. Frawley.
How in tarnation can a soap save your life?
Well, maybe I put it too strongly, but if it weren't for Happy Soap, I'd still be in a hassle with my daughter.
How's that?
You really want to hear this?
Yeah. gone.
Well, for years I've been shampooing my daughter Maggie's hair with a pine tar shampoo.
Huh?
With a pine tar shampoo.
Oh.
And today she refused to let me.
Why?
Because she said the shampoo smelled like the cracks in the schoolyard.
Now, our first two films today were both somewhat dark, emotional dramas. This one is a glittering, colourful comedy from producer Ross Hunter, whose influence shaped much of what we recall about this period in cinema, I think. Now, Doris Day plays happy housewife Beverly Boyer, married to a respected doctor played by James Garner, and she's a mother to two young children too. They live in a big, beautiful house. They have a maid. It's the picture of a 1960s American dream. But things take some very interesting turns when Beverly stumbles upon the opportunity to star in some television commercials for a brand of, fittingly enough, soap. Suddenly she's working late a few nights a week, making public appearances, and her face stares down at her cranky husband from a billboard as he drives home from his normal job, painfully reminding him that his wife makes more money than he does. Karen, I'm not entirely sure whether this film intends to be as clever as it is. What did you make of it?
Well, I've never seen it before, so it was very interesting to me to watch it. And the starring roles are just amazing. I mean, Doris Day and James Garner are really wonderful, wonderful to watch. It is just on the edge of starting to understand the realities of suburbia. Mm. It's got a huge fantasy element. I mean, and it reminded me of, there was a malt shop in Hollywood where if you sat there, you would be discovered. Well, the interesting thing is that she becomes discovered by going to this dinner party with her husband, and she gets to go on television. Just like, how would you like to go on television? Oh, okay. So,
it's very much like that.
In front of the cameras, and there she is. And of course, it's Doris Day. And you're watching this, and you think this would never fly because she's on for minutes. You know, normally it would be at 15 seconds and off. And you can hear the people laughing at her, and she's humiliated.
A very different time, though, of course, because commercials had to be done live back then. There weren't the constant barrage of yelling voiceovers that we have today.
Well, that was quite interesting, the fact that the dramas that she's sort of sandwiching there with her happy soap is live. And of course, they all star Carl Reiner. If you're not careful, you can just see him in there. And I think what's really exciting about this is the fact that suburbia in this guise is glamorous. It's full of potential. It's also full of some very real problems. For example, the children are really annoying. They're very, very
hard. I thought
they
were amazing.
They're lovely, but they have their own theme song, which is this dissonant sort of panpipe. And every time you see a child, you hear that tune. I'll never want to hear that tune again.
In all honesty, I usually dislike children in cinema.
Do you
cinema.
Like these children?
I really like these children. I thought they were hilarious.
They're very smart. They are very smart and very cute, I have to say. But but purposely not. They're supposed to be naughty but lovable. Of course, a boy and a girl, idealism again.
Perfect.
He's a doctor. He delivers children.
He's very respected by everyone that knows him. And she, of course, is then part of that respect as well, being the wife of a doctor. What could be better?
That's right. And she says, that should be enough for me, instead of posing in your lingerie for soap or looking down or kissing soap. There's a wonderful scene where she's doing a commercial for the soap and she's having to kiss the soap. And I think she says, this has been 6 hours where I'm kissing soap. Open and keep going. So that was really quite sweet. It's actually a very sweet story. It's a wish fulfillment, this film. It's how we wanted life to be, full of potential, full of glamour. We've got people to do the hard work. We've got nannies and other people. And we've got the wealthy magnates that can grant our smallest wish.
That does bring us to the end of this week's show. Special thanks to my guest today, Karen Krzanovich. Don't forget that if you are here in the UK, you can catch Revolutionary Road alongside Spielberg's Catch Me If You Can as a double DiCaprio bill on MUBI. Listen again to this show and find out more at monocle.com or subscribe to the podcast at iTunes or SoundCloud. And you can always get in touch with me by sending me an email, br@monocle.com. The Cinema Show returns next week. Until then, I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening.